Welcome to the Farm to Table Talk podcast, where we talk about our food system from what we eat to how it's grown. I'm your host, Roger Wasson. Improving food systems is a high priority all over the world. This farm-to-table talk is about changes that are taking place in India with the help of Cornell University's Tata Cornell Institute for Agriculture and Nutrition. Established with a generous gift from the Tata Trust, the Institute is a long-term research initiative focused on solving problems of poverty, malnutrition, and rural development in India. Our conversation with the founder and director, Dr. Prabhu Pingali, and Tata Cornell PhD scholar Maureen Valentine, covers the gamut from the Green Revolution to changing crop systems to nutritional gender issues from living in rural India. We're going to find out what they're doing in India, what is changing because of their work, and what we can learn from the efforts to change food systems around the world. Professor Pingali sets the stage.
Well, most of my career has been doing work on food and agriculture policy. And I've spent a lot of my career looking at the problem of hunger, food security, and malnutrition across the world. I've spent a lot of time looking at it in Africa and also in Asia. But over the years, I had sort of drifted from doing research to doing more of management of research and management of programs, first through the United Nations and then with the Gates Foundation. So this was a nice way to come back into academia and to try and bring together a lot of things I've learned as a development practitioner and bring some high-quality, rigorous research back into my thinking.
Where did you grow up, Prabhu?
Actually, I was born in a small village in southern India. It was a rice-growing village, and that was one of the early villages that adopted the Green Revolution rice technology in South India. And from there, I went to school in Rajasthan in India, and then moved on to study in the United States.
You might explain the Green Revolution. There's people that have heard of it, but really couldn't give you a good explanation. So when you refer to the Green Revolution, what is that?
So the Green Revolution is technology change that took place in some of the basic staple grains that the developing world depends on for their daily food and for their food security. These are rice and wheat and maize. In the mid-60s, there was technological breakthrough where new varieties of rice and wheat were produced that could give you 4 to 5 or sometimes 6 tons per hectare, whereas the traditional varieties were giving around a ton. Farmers who switched to these new varieties suddenly found themselves getting 3 to 4 times as much yield as they were getting prior to the Green Revolution period. So the Green Revolution has had a phenomenal impact in terms of improving overall food supplies and improving overall food security. For the very poor population, it's had a particularly strong impact in countries like India and China, Indonesia, Mexico, etc.
Was it something that growing up in India, you realized and recognized that more food was being produced because of this?
Oh, absolutely. On our own farm, when I was growing up, we could see that change happen. You know, most of my schooling and my sibling's schooling was paid from the increased income that came out of our farm with adopting these new high-yielding rice varieties. Prior to the 60s, my father was growing just one crop of rice a year at about a ton per hectare. And after the Green Revolution, he was growing 2 crops of rice, and he was getting an average of 4 tons and sometimes 5 tons per crop. So he was making about 8 to 10 tons in a year. And that made a phenomenal difference in the income that was coming out of the farm. And that helped us get better education and then move into other professions, like I went into being an economist, etc. And that understanding that that's how it started was with us from when we were very young children.
Describe a farm in southern India to me, because I've been farms all over the United States and around the world. I've been to India, but I have been on a farm in India.
An average farm in southern India would be around an acre and a half. Sometimes 2 acres. That's about what it was then and even now. Now, I must admit that our farm was much bigger than that. We were cultivating around 15 acres. So by Indian standards, we were not small farmers, but certainly by U.S. standards, we're tiny farmers.
Just rice?
We did mainly rice, but after the rice crop, we would plant vegetables, some pulses. You know, Indians eat a dish called dal, where you have pulses that you mix with rice. So we would grow those pulses after the rice crop and then grow a second rice crop after that. So through the entire year, the land was covered with one crop. And that was a big change. And certainly this whole area, this was a river basin, so there was good water supply. The irrigation systems worked very well. So the transformation took place quite rapidly in these areas once the technology came in.
At what stage did you decide not only that you were going to be going on to a university to study, but that it would have something to do with food or food production?
I studied economics in college. When I was doing economics, I wasn't particularly thinking about working in food or agriculture. But then during a summer internship, I ended up working in one of the agriculture research centers for the summer and in Hyderabad, which is the closest city to our village. And that's where I really got interested in agriculture and food issues. And so I ended up coming to North Carolina State to study agricultural economics for my PhD. And from there, I stuck to food and agriculture issues for the rest of my career.
Now, Maureen, we need to bring you into this now. And I'm just going to take a wild guess and say you probably didn't grow up on a farm in India. But did you? Where did you grow up?
So I actually grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And I also went to NC State for my undergrad in animal science.
Why did you decide to get into animal science?
I mean, I always wanted to work with animals. It was a passion that I had.
You didn't grow up on a farm, though?
Nope. I grew up in the suburbs of Charlotte.
What did you think would be at the end of the education that you were putting yourself through?
At the time of my undergrad, I really wasn't clear. But then I ended up traveling for a few years. So I lived in the Czech Republic. I lived in Chile. I lived in Vietnam. For about 4 to 5 years, traveling, teaching English as a foreign language, and working for various tourism companies. And that's where I kind of came. I was actually in Burma one time, and I saw all these goats. And it kind of just dawned on me how goats can be used as a way to improve livelihoods and help people get out of poverty. And that's when I decided to come back to Cornell and study my master's in international agriculture and rural development.
Ah, and then you got into the particular program.
Right. So then I got funding from the Tata Cornell Institute, and that took me to India. So I did a goat research project in Rajasthan for 4 months. So I kind of had a little taste of the applied research at that point, and then ended up coming back and getting funding to continue my PhD.
What is there to learn about goat production in India?
Well, kind of the interesting thing about goats is that, well, in India, people don't eat beef. That's definitely a caveat that's different from the United States. So beef, cows in general, are a sacred animal, and they definitely drink a lot of milk. India is the largest milk producer in the world, but they don't eat the beef. And so goats are actually the most common protein source of animal source food. So different from the United States. In the United States, the main goat or small ruminants would be goat and sheep market would be ethnic communities. But in India, goat is the main source of meat protein. So for that reason, it's a very high-value commodity.
How did you come to the decisions on the kind of program that you would have to put into place?
I knew from the start that the center needed to focus on India and that it needed to focus on addressing the malnutrition problem in India and looking at the role of agriculture in addressing that. When I first got to Cornell, then I essentially took off and went to India and spent a month driving across country looking at various various agriculture systems, spent a lot of time in rural communities. Myself and Bhaskar Mitra, who's the associate director of the center, who's based in India, actually. We both got in a car and we drove in that summer. I think we drove about 2,000 miles and we went across 6 states and really immersed ourselves in the issues around food and agriculture. And I came out of that trip with an idea of what are some of the priority areas we need to focus on for the center, and then wrote that up and started presenting it. And that became the overall framework for the institution. That's the one that most of our students now work around.
When you're driving 2,000 miles across India, did you always have somebody there to kind of meet you and introduce you to farmers, or did sometimes you just have to pull into a village and go knock on doors all?
So mostly we had contacts that we went to. So we had contacts with NGO groups across the country. We had contacts with research institutions across the country. We made a sort of itinerary going from one location to the other, going from one organization to another organization. And in each case, we were visiting their work. We were visiting the farm communities they were working with. And so our ability to communicate with those groups was a lot easier than just pulling up by the side of the road and talking to whoever we found them.
Did you get invited into people's homes? So you come
all the time. Oh, yeah, all the time. Even now when we're in the field, we pretty much, almost every single time that we're in the field, we end up either having a meal or a cup of coffee or snacks with the farm groups that we visit. Farmers tend to be extremely hospitable. And I find that to be true across the world, but it's been particularly true in the communities in India that we visited and that we're working with now.
I find it true across the world, too. I mean, every place I've been, the States and some other countries, you know, say, come on, sit down, have a cup of coffee, talk to us, or join us for lunch, and we'll have a few neighbors in. Maureen, did you have similar experiences when you were on the ground in India?
Oh, yeah. The farmers are, I mean, I was always so surprised how much time people will give you, I mean, sitting down for a survey. I mean, people have things to do. They need to go out to the field, so you know that their time is very valuable, but people are extremely hospitable and always, and once again, you know these people don't have a lot of money, they probably don't have a lot of milk, but they always want to give you a cup of chai or they want to provide you whatever they do have in their homes, which is really nice.
Well, describe a typical experience. So you're out someplace and you're on a farm. I can't even envision it. It's a freestanding house. Are there barns or other buildings around?
So I think it really varies across the country. I mean, India is a massive country, so things are quite different. But in the places where my research has been, it's probably, if you could just imagine, the most rural place you could depict in your mind. But usually a lot of places might have straw roofs or they might have a tin roof if it's been upgraded, like kind of like a mud house, or sometimes they'll use cow patties as a form of like a front walkway or something like that. But yeah, it's usually just a grouping of houses as a village, and of course the fields are all around the village. But very subsistence farming.
And you go in and you're sitting around possibly around a kitchen table, and in the case of Prabhu, in the case that you would have a meal, what might be a typical meal?
It varies as you go from the south to the north of the country. As in the south, a typical meal would be rice with some vegetables and some dal, the lentil that I talked about earlier. And that would pretty much be a typical meal that you'd get in a farm community. As you go up north, you begin to see the rice becoming less common, and you begin to see chapatis, which are wheat-based Indian bread, replacing rice. But the vegetables are still there, the dal is still there. And yogurt is another very common thing that people would serve with a meal in India, across India.
Well, and Maureen, I'd like to be with you having some chai. I love chai, but I find that around the United States, it's you've been able to find chai like you would have in India since you've come back home?
Oh, it's never the same, but I have to admit the chai in India is always a little too sweet for me.
I like the hot spicy chai myself. So in these conversations, that whether you're sitting around a kitchen table in India or you're having, you're talking to the farmers, and or in your case probably driving 2,000 miles, and you come away with conclusions of what could be most helpful for them. Now, is it typical that these farmers are saying, what, I have an insect issue, or I have a marketing issue, or I'm just not getting the yields I should get? What was distilling from the feedback that you were getting?
So normally when we go into a village, we probably find ourselves sitting in one of these village squares under a tree, or in a community hall, or one of these places where people start to gather. And so within about half an hour, you'll have 15 to 20 farmers sitting around us. And then we start talking about what they do, their agriculture practices, their food consumption practices, etc. And as we go through that discussion, we start to ask about, okay, what's the most important problem that you're facing in agriculture, in your crop production? What's the most important problem you're facing in terms of access to food, etc.? So we go through a series of discussions like that. And from that, we are able to come out saying, here are the four or five things that we would consider priorities for this community. And as we go community by community, we are able to then collate across these priorities. And that's the way in which we do participatory research with farmers. We get farmers to be part of this process of identifying what they need and prioritize what they need. And that has shaped our program and the priorities that we are working with in the program.
And Maureen, in your case, is it specifically the livestock side when you're having conversations with farmers?
Well, my PhD research, I was in India for a year for that time. So I was working with the same farmers over the course of the year to implement a semi-stall feeding operation and compare that to their control, which was an open grazing, no input type system. Over that time, because I was working with the same farmers every day, so I really kind of became a part of those communities. I really came to know those people, and I was kind of a fixture in those villages after a good amount of time. So, of course, I'm asking about the livestock, but I'm also looking at their hygiene practices. I'm looking at their income. I'm looking at how many children they have, and it's kind of I think it takes on a whole ethnographic type feel because I want to understand the whole context. So, I mean, there's the livestock, but then there's also this bigger picture around the livestock.
Well, when you're living there for a year, what do you do when you're not working, when you're not doing the research? Is there, I don't know, if you go hiking or running, or are there theaters to go to? Or
I didn't have much spare time, I would say. I was in the rural areas, so it's just a tiny little village of a few hundred people. There's not much in the way of entertainment. And pretty much by the time the sun goes down, you should be inside, so you're not really roaming the streets or anything. And I didn't have internet either. So I was pretty focused on the project for that amount of time, so I won't say that I had too many extracurriculars.
Well, when you say you shouldn't be out roaming the streets, did you feel unsafe?
Yeah, there's a safety factor for sure, also being a woman. And there's nobody on the streets at night. I mean, once again, it's a farming community, so people are going to sleep, and there's not really anything to do.
But I assume everybody has TVs, right?
No.
Oh.
No. Yeah.
Well, then the next question was going to be, what about smartphones? What penetration is there for internet access or smartphones? And then probably a question for you as well.
So I didn't see too many smartphones in the rural areas. They definitely have flip phones, so everybody has a phone, those kind of old-school Nokia phones or like a normal flip phone, but smartphones, I would say, are more popular in the urban areas.
So I think Maureen was in a really remote part of India, in Orissa, and there you had much less penetration of overall power and TVs and all of that. But as you get into other parts of India, which are more developed, you find rural areas have much better power connection. And TV penetration is quite substantial. But I think smartphones are still quite few. Most of the the cell phones are the old switch phones in rural areas. In urban areas, of course, smartphones are pretty much everywhere. Almost everyone has a smartphone. But that's the growth that I would see. If in the next 5 years, you'll begin to see massive smartphone penetration into rural areas. So looking ahead in terms of how we can use internet for better farming, I think we would focus on technologies that can be transmitted, information on technologies that can be transmitted through smartphones.
When you found out the needs of the farmers, and Maureen has one in her area, and you've had it in driving across India and talking to people, so what are the major project areas that you tackle at the center?
When we were driving across, one of the things that strikes you immediately is that Indian agriculture is so focused on staple grains, so focused on rice and wheat and maize to some extent. So pretty much all the food system provides is calories. And you don't see much diversity in the food system, either in terms of access to protein-based food or access to micronutrient-rich food or vitamin-rich food, etc. So vegetables, fruit, livestock products, etc. are very limited in a very traditional agriculture system in India. So a priority for our program was, how do you go from a rice or a wheat-based agriculture system to a more diversified agriculture? And what are the technologies we need to bring in order to make that happen? And how do you get government policy to change in order to give farmers the incentives to move out of staple grains and into other commodities and higher nutrition value commodities, and both from a crop and a livestock side? So that was a big priority that we identified. So several of our students are actually looking at what those opportunities are. One of our students is also looking at, how do you bring in biofortification, where you breed in higher levels of a micronutrient, higher levels of a vitamin? So she's working with sweet potatoes, and she's looking at sweet potatoes that have high levels of vitamin A, and introducing the sweet potato into rural populations in North India. So that's another way in which we're bringing technology that improves the nutritional quality of the food. So we're also looking at, how do you change behavior? So because it's not just enough to improve the quality of the food system, you also need to create demand for better diet, and getting farmers, farm households to appreciate better quality diets and to demand more diversity in their diets, to create a way in which women in the household have access to better quality diets similar to the men, and girls having access to better quality diets like the boys do, etc. These are some of the behavior change issues that we've been focused on. And finally, we're also looking a lot into the role of clean drinking water and sanitation, access to toilets, use of toilets, etc. As part of the nutrition equation. Because it's not enough just to eat good food, but your body should be able to absorb it and convert that into nutrients. And you can't do that if the drinking water system is polluted, or if you're living in an unsanitary situation. So we're trying to tackle each one of these issues around nutrition. And we have students that are working across each of these areas in trying to address nutrition. So that's our concept of a food system.
Boy, you said so many things that had my head spinning there. One thing I think I heard you say, that there's a different diet available for men and boys than for women and girls. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. There's what we in economics call intra-household inequity in access to food. So you find that in many traditional rural communities in India, women eat last. First, the men and the boys are fed, and then the girls are fed. And finally, the woman who does the cooking and who takes care of the children, etc., she's the one who gets to eat last, and she gets to eat whatever is left behind. And quite often, she may not have any of the higher quality food left for her to consume. So we've been quite focused on behavior change programs where we talk about improving the equity in access to food within the household itself, and talk about why it's important for women to have equal access to high-quality food as the men. So it's part of this whole process of gender empowerment that we're working on.
Well, Maureen, I have to ask you, Maureen, as a woman working there for nearly a year, did you either witness this or experience it yourself in some way?
Yeah, I mean, it's fairly pervasive all over the country. I mean, women certainly act differently around men. In Rajasthan, for example, women are required to pull the veil over their face if they're in the presence of a man outside of their family. So behavior is very different in different when women are with different groups of men, and certainly access to food is different, of course.
Did you sit down with the men when you ate and get the same food that they had?
Yeah, well, I think my situation is a little bit different, though, because I'm an outsider, and so I think I have a different social status. And I mean, I'm a bit of a celebrity when I'm in the village, so it's kind of an exciting thing, as opposed to, you know, their wives or the daughters.
You've identified so many things to work on. Prabhu, I would think that it would be a challenge even to prioritize, because just in this conversation, you've mentioned a broad range of areas, and you have a program that's funded, and you have a team working, but what would be the three program areas that would be your top program areas right now?
The work we're doing on diversifying the production system, bringing in new crops into the system, is I think our top priority. And that includes bringing in vegetables and fruit and legumes and lentil crops into the system. It's a big part of what we are trying to research and promote in rural areas. The second big priority for us is around empowerment of women and behavior change that's happening. And our third big priority is sanitation. Mm-hmm. We have, one of our students is looking at why you still have so many people who don't use latrines, and how do you get improved access to latrines in rural areas, and how do you get improved access to clean drinking water in rural areas. So that's another big part of what we are doing. And so we have students that are working in different parts of this big puzzle that we've laid out for ourselves. And, you know, depending on the students' interests, we're able to fit them in because the problem is so complex. And that's helped a lot. So we don't necessarily have to say our priorities are 1, 2, and 3, but we can say here are the top 5 priorities, and then be able to bring students into each of these areas and then try and synthesize across and see how each of their parts can create a whole that's bigger than each of them and the linkages that come together between them.
Well, Maureen, you were working particularly with goats. Did that exist, or were you able to propose this as an area that you wanted to make your primary focus?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I was attracted to the Tata Cornell Institute, and it's really exciting to be a part of such a diverse group of students doing so many different things, and we kind of go into our little, you know, our specific fields, and we work on our specific ideas, and then you kind of come all back together, and you see the breadth of it, and it's really amazing. But yeah, so I think small ruminants, like I said, they're such an important source of protein, and consumption of animal source foods is so low in India, one of the lowest per capita in the world. And I really feel like that's a huge part of the equation of creating a more nutritious food system, particularly for women and children that are growing up and helping with the wasting and the stunting issue. Improved access to small ruminant products is going to be important. And also, right now, the commodity itself is so expensive that even the people that are raising the goats, because usually goats tend to be in the hands of smallholders, wouldn't actually have the money to eat goat meat. So trying to improve the productivity of the product so eventually we could hopefully get more product on the market and people that don't have as higher incomes could eventually get access to it.
Well, you said something else there that caught my attention. You were saying that the wasting and stunting, can you explain that?
So these are different measurements of malnutrition. So stunting is a height measurement and wasting is a circumference measurement. You can look at the arm band, and it's a way that you can measure the malnutrition of a population.
But these are things that we just don't think about very much here, and we should think about it. And we're fortunate that you are and that this program is as well. And I want to wrap up on a couple of key points. And that is, I think probably you grew up in a village in India and you were around farmers growing up. Are they better off today than they were when you were a child?
Oh, absolutely. I was actually back in my village just last month. And it's very, very different from the time when I was growing up. There's a lot more prosperity than when I was a child in that village. A lot more houses that are made of brick. We have a tar road. There's electricity. There's telephones, TVs, etc. But, you know, I come from a relatively prosperous part of the country. But where Maureen was working, I suspect the villages there look today the same way as they looked 50 years ago. There may have been very little change in those villages. So in India, you have this enormous diversity in the progress that's happened, where certain regions are moving rapidly towards becoming more commercial, modern societies, and others which are still left behind as they were 50 years ago. And so that's the big challenge that we are facing.
Well, I'm wondering, Maureen, if in that area, if you get a sense from the people that you were around in the part of India that you were at, that they really don't believe things are ever going to change. Do you find optimism?
Oh, yeah. Indian people are super optimistic. So I mean, they're also very accepting. I think they accept what their life is, but they also are really optimistic and always looking for new opportunities. And I think that they are hopeful for change in the future.
Well, what makes you hopeful for change in the future? What from your experience makes you feel like there's going to be progress over the next, you know, 4 or 5 years?
In my specific situation, it was basically a no input system. So the animals are turned free and they're just openly grazing. And so I did introduce a semi-stall feeding system. And at that point, the farmers had literally no idea that you could feed goats something other than fresh grass. I provided straw, like a dried straw, and in the beginning, the farmers just told me adamantly that their goats will not eat straw. Their goats only eat fresh forages. And over the course of the projects, they saw their goats eat straw, and they realized that goats can eat other things, and it was actually like you could see the light bulb go off in their heads like, oh my gosh, there's other options. And by the end of the project, we did a fodder cultivation workshop, and they were all super excited about it and really motivated to see what they could do on their lands and how they could implement this. And I think that is really motivating for me.
Well, and Prabhu, I'm going to ask you, too, about what gives you the most hope and optimism for the future. But I want to start off with something else, and that is that you had an experience when you were at the Gates Foundation that was certainly beyond India. Gates works around the world and has done some outstanding programs around the world. And as you were talking earlier, I found myself wondering whether or not there's not similar situations, especially where they're focused on just producing staples, which, as you were pointing out, just provides calories. It's not necessarily giving the phytonutrients and the what people need to have to thrive and have very good nutrition. So I would suspect that the kind of problem that you're tackling in India has broader application. Would that be a good assumption?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You begin to see this this evolution that's taking place in diets becoming a lot more common across the developing world as incomes are rising. But food policy hasn't caught up with it. Food policy is still very much stuck on staple grains. And so one of the things that we are doing is providing models that can then be used in other parts of the world. So the Gates Foundation is actually partnering with us now. The Gates Foundation has given us an additional grant in order to promote, to scale up some of the issues that we're working on in India. And then that can then be used as a model to take to other parts of the world where the Gates Foundation is operating, especially sub-Saharan Africa. So that's something we're excited about.
You know, one thing, as you describe this, I think that in some respects it's similar to concerns expressed in the United States, that so much of our policy is focused on staple, corn, soybeans, wheat, rice, those main grains, and not so much vegetables. So that comes up here. We talk about monocropping, but we also talk about people that are lower income in the States that are not getting as many, certainly is not fruits and vegetables, and that can probably be said about people of all different income levels, but that the need for us to have more vegetables in our diet than we do currently too. So maybe it is a global issue.
Oh, absolutely. The more I work on this area, the more I see similarities with food policy problems in the U.S., and certainly in other parts of the developing world. So over time, the same sorts of issues that lead to obesity are also leading to some of the malnutrition problems that we have in the developing world. And the solutions are the same. The solutions are improved access to fresh fruit, vegetable, vitamin-based products, and micronutrient-rich products, etc. So that's something that I take away from the work that I'm doing in India.
Well, if people would like to know more about your program, and perhaps they would like to get involved in your program directly and somehow, how can they find out information that we didn't get covered today?
So we're really excited to get young people to be part of our program, because that's the way in which we can grow this program and also build capacity in this program. And so one of the best ways to find us is actually if you Google Tata Cornell Institute, that'll get you straight to us. But also they can come in through our website, which is tci.cornell.edu.
Well, I really appreciate having you both on Farm to Table Talk today. So thank you to Prabhu Pingali and Maureen Valentine for being on Farm to Table Talk.
We really enjoyed this. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much for having us.
You've been listening to Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.